The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Derek Dorch of the Diversa Group, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and careers. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dorch.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thank you for stopping by the show. We are always glad to have you. Hey, today we're going to be talking about an important issue, and we've talked about this issue before, but we're going to be talking about cyber, and we're going to be talking about cyber crimes. What's going on in this world? We're hearing a lot about different things. We're hearing about the Russians that are attacking the DNC and the DCCC. We're hearing about the Chinese and different espionage acts and them trying to get into different cyber networks. We're hearing about hacktivists, and we're hearing about kind of the dynamic of the insider threats, and we're also hearing about just pure organized crimes or just even that individual hacker who's stealing people's identities. We're trying to figure out, where is cyber going right now? Where are the threats? Where are these crimes going? And what is the future of crimes right now? We're talking to Mark Goodman. He's the author of a book called Future Crimes. And if I could recommend any book that you read before the year is out, it is Future Crimes. It will definitely open your eyes about the cyber threat, about cyber crimes, and even about how big companies are using kind of information in terms of big data and everything else. You can find his book at futurecrimesbook.com. Hey, Mark, thank you for joining us on Fed Access.
Thank you, Derek. My pleasure to be here.
Hey, you know, I was talking to you, Mark, and I was telling you this book kind of really opened my eyes, kind of changed my life in terms of how I view cyber and just the connectivity of things. You know, tell us right now, I mean, one, give us a little background about you, Mark, and you know, how did you get to this point? I know you came out of law enforcement. Give us some background about you, and then how did you get from where you came from in law enforcement all the way up to this point right now when you wrote the Future Crimes book and then understanding this current threat?
Well, as you mentioned, I started out as a police officer, originally from New York, and then joined the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department, worked there doing traditional law enforcement stuff, a police officer, investigator, all that sort of patrol stuff that you do. And I started to see an uptick in how criminals were using technology. And back in the day, it was pagers and cell phones, long before they were popular, you know, the way they are today. Today, everybody's got a cell phone. But back in the 80s, the only people that had cell phones and pagers were doctors. And you would see these, you know, street dealers that had all this tech. And it was kind of baffling to police because they were able to use these to communicate in ways to effectively evade law enforcement. So I started to look a little bit more close at that. And then eventually people started getting home computers. And again, drug dealers, gang members, they were there early stages. So I got to see that criminals were early adopters of technology. So I had proposed the need to start a high-tech crime unit, and I ended up founding the Internet Unit for the LAPD in the mid to late 90s, and went and saw that even though we were beginning to put together some law enforcement resources around the problem, the bad guys were running ahead of us and then further and further and further ahead. So, and I also saw that the problem was growing, and it was growing internationally. It wasn't something that local police could handle anymore, because we were starting to decouple the criminal and the location of the crime and law enforcement. So throughout history, you know, if a bad guy was committing a robbery in DuPont Circle at a bank, we would know that the D.C. Metropolitan Police would handle it. We might have the FBI come in and do the investigation. We knew that the physical criminal was present there, right? That he left behind evidence, DNA, fingerprints, video surveillance footage, and all of that was now gone in the age of internet crime, because you could have criminals anywhere around the world still attacking banks in DuPont Circle or the Shaw District or Anacostia or any part of any city. And that really broke the internet. I always like to say that the internet broke policing, because the criminals can roam around the world, hopping from country to country and jurisdiction to jurisdiction at free will, whereas law enforcement is tied to a city, county, state, or federal government.
You know, do you still feel that that's the case? And before I kind of get into how we're connected, with, which was the first part of your chapter, do you still feel like law enforcement is still behind the curve, especially kind of even in your local jurisdictions, but maybe even federal, international? Are we there where we are really, completely capable of investigating the crimes the way we should be? I mean, based on what you have seen and based on where you have come from?
Absolutely not. On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd give law enforcement a 1 or a 2.
Wow.
And it's not because police are uninterested. It's not because they're lazy. It's not because they don't want to help citizens. It's just that the two systems are completely mismatched. A New York City police officer will never be able to make an arrest in Moscow. And so criminals know that. And the same way that there were money laundering havens back in the day where people would hang out, you know, in the Virgin Islands and other countries so that they could launder money and didn't have to worry about banking secrecy laws, the same thing has happened now. We have cybercrime havens. And so even if a, you know, New York City police officer or San Francisco police officer could identify the criminal in Moscow or in China, Brazil, wherever they might be, you're counting entirely on the local law enforcement in that country to be supportive of your case in San Francisco. And the fact of the matter is that many of those agencies, frankly, are on the take. That is, they get paid off by the criminals, so they are not going to help you with your local case. So the internet broke policing, and it comes down to jurisdiction. That's why after the LAPD, I went on to work for nearly a decade with Interpol, because I realized that fundamentally that this is an international policing issue.
You know, with Interpol and like you said, I mean, a lot of these crimes, whether it be cyber terrorism or people just getting, you know, and grabbing credit cards or anything like that and stealing people's identities, people are going to, like you mentioned, different safe havens, and whether it be Africa or Europe or wherever the case is, where, like you said, law enforcement may not be that active in that, and they're oftentimes they may be getting bribes. With that, do you see that there needs to be an increase? There needs to be maybe a new agency, or does Interpol need to be funded more? Does there need to be something that has some teeth that can really kind of really bring justice? Or even would that be even difficult, given the nature that you have to go over borders and work with different police agencies? You know, how do we get past that?
So it's a great question. And I think that most people who work in law enforcement think that we need to improve law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
In a minute, I'll give you a more radical solution. So let's pretend that we did create some sort of world policing group. And I am not suggesting this, but let's pretend for argument's sake that we did do that. That means great. So a New York City police officer has arrest authority and can go kick down a door in Moscow and arrest Igor, the cyber criminal. But in order for that to happen, that also means that, you know, Lieutenant Colonel Olaf of the Moscow police would also have to have a responsibility and ability to go kick down a door in Brooklyn,
right,
New York.
Right.
And I don't
right.
think that most Americans are going to want Russian police knocking at their door and right. dragging them back to Moscow. So the only way that this can work is via cooperation. But as I said, cooperation is weak, frankly. And the other big challenge is one of law. You can only arrest people for things that are illegal. And there's only about 70 to 80 countries in the world that actually even have cybercrime laws in the year 2016. So in order for something to be illegal in a foreign country, they need to pass a law about it. So this is the whole concept in international law of what's called dual criminality. And I'll give you an example. Here in America, we have free speech. In certain parts of the world, that doesn't exist. So if Germany, where it's illegal to espouse Nazi propaganda today, but perfectly legal for a U.S. citizen to do it. If some U.S. citizen was in his constitutional First Amendment right to say, hey, I think the Nazis are great, that's completely legal in America. It is illegal in Germany. If Germany tried to extradite that U.S. citizen, we could not extradite them because there's no dual criminality. What they want to be extradited for is not a crime here. Or you could look at women driving in Saudi Arabia, right? That's a crime in Riyadh. It's not a crime in Chicago. So if a woman who drove in Saudi Arabia fled to Chicago, there's no way the U.S. government's going to extradite her for that back to Saudi Arabia because it's not illegal. So one of the other big problems that we have is that we have lack of dual criminality, since the overwhelming majority of countries don't even have cybercrime laws. Therefore, to get to the kernel of the issue, I'm not sure that law enforcement is actually the right way to handle these issues. I'm saying that as a former law enforcement officer, because the police will never develop the powers that are necessary and will never have the speed that's required. So instead, in my book, I talk about a different option, which is applying sort of a medical model to this security issue. And I bring up the example of the CDC in Atlanta or the World Health Organization, right? If somebody has the Zika virus and they're in Brazil, or somebody's got Ebola and they're in West Africa, the World Health Organization doesn't try to arrest people. It tries to isolate them. It tries to treat them, and it tries to make sure that the problem doesn't spread around the world so that other people can avoid becoming sick. That's a good model. That's one that scales, and it scales internationally. We use the language of medicine to talk about cybercrime. We talk about computer infections. We talk about computer viruses, but we don't use the tools of medicine, things like epidemiology and public health, to actually get to the core of the issue. So it's my strong belief that we will never arrest our way out of this problem. We need to use an epidemiological approach, study the disease of cybercrime, so to speak, get to its core, and try to resolve those issues. So prevention is actually the best way to go.
We're talking to Mark Goodman. He is the author of a book called Future Crimes. If you type in Google, you can find it. But the website is futurecrimesbook.com. It's an amazing book. I've read it. That's why I asked Mark to be on the show. After I read it, it definitely opened my eyes about the dynamics of cyber and how do we deal possibly with these future crimes. We're going to get into some other stuff that's going to kind of blow your mind, as we talked about the connectivity and we talked about where the crimes are going with cyber and other areas in relation to technology and how we're interconnected. And so please stay tuned, because there's a lot more interesting stuff to come. We're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been talking about crimes. We've been talking about cyber crimes. We've been talking about future crimes. Where is this going? It's not just on the computer anymore. It's going well beyond the computer. Everything is becoming integrated. Everything is becoming connected. And with all of that, it also provides some opportunities for people who are not the best people, not of the best public discourse. They want to try to kind of say, listen, maybe we can profit off of other people. Maybe we can get their information and steal their identities. Maybe we can, kidnap somebody through the dynamics of using technology. So there's a number of different things that we have to be concerned about. And whether it be a government agency or you're an individual, these cyber crimes are real. We're talking to Mark Goodman. He is the author of the book Future Crimes. I definitely recommend that you read it. It's a New York Times bestseller, Wall Street Journal bestseller. Excellent book. Very, very insightful. Very, very helpful, especially for anyone who is thinking about the future of future crimes. You know, Mark, as we look at this kind of piece right here, you had a book in chapter one talks about, you know, how connected we are becoming. Talk about that. I mean, what, you know, how connected are we becoming right now with all the tools? I mean, we got the phones, we got the computers, and now our cars are really mobile computers for the most part. Where is the connectivity and what is the vulnerability of that right now?
So if you think about crime in the old days, and particularly computer crime, you know, computers were something that in the 80s and 90s, most people used at work. And then eventually they found their ways into their house. And if you would have asked somebody in 1985, do you have a cell phone? They would have looked at you with crossed eyes. They wouldn't have known what you were talking about. But today, certainly here in the United States, the overwhelming majority of people have access to at least a mobile phone of some sort, and many, many have access to a computer. And so we're seeing more people have these tools, and therefore criminals are going after them because they can get useful information that they can either sell or use to steal your identity, can make credit card fraud, any of those types of issues. But it goes beyond today's computers and laptops, because slowly but surely, every physical object in our world is becoming an information technology. And I'll give you an example of that. You know, we used to have phones that had dials on them. Today, those dumb phones have become smartphones. We used to have sort of old school thermostats in our houses. Today, those are becoming the Google Nest. The television was something where you had to get up and change the channel and move the knob. Now we've got smart televisions that are connected to the internet. Average automobile today has over 250 microchips. So cars are becoming smarter. They're being run by computers. And every physical object, the smart home is coming online, where your security cameras and your alarm system, all of that is coming online. According to Cisco, we're going to add 50 billion new devices to the internet by 2020. So the numbers are growing, and they're growing massively. And every physical object will eventually be online one way or another, whether it's your coffee pot, your microwave, or even your kids. There are some schools today that are making kids wear RFID identifiers so that they can be tracked as they walk around the school. So it's coming. It's coming. And the challenge is that all of this technology is hackable. There's never been built a computer system that could not be hacked. It just comes down to time, money, and attention. With enough of those three things, you can break into any system. And since you were talking about the federal government earlier, we've seen this, right? We've
right.
seen Department of Defense hack. We've seen Homeland Security hack. We've seen OPM hack,
yeah.
right? We've seen, you just mentioned the DNC being hacked. So everything eventually is hackable.
And you know what, Mark, let me just interject real quick. I mean, I tell me if you think this, but I think at OPM people thought, you know, hey, this is just human resource personnel records. I mean, everybody thought they're trying to go for the nuclear secrets, right, or the intellectual
right.
property. But now it seems as if we have to reassess the crown jewels of everything, right? I mean, wherever information yep. can be utilized, I mean, somebody will try to possibly dig into that. Is that true?
Absolutely. And by the way, OPM was in fact the crown jewel. So sure, it wasn't the nuclear missile launch codes for our ICBMs, but you had all these federal employees in that system, people from the Department of Defense, FBI agents, people from the intelligence community, and you know the country that carried it out, and there's lots of people saying who exactly that country is, have access to all that data. So
right.
your federal news audience would know about a form called the SF-86, which is like a 100-page life story of
yeah, right.
everybody out there. And that makes great fodder for foreign intelligence services who want to recruit American spies or go after them, uncover who they are, etc. So that was quite a coup. So this is all hackable. And the challenge is when it was just your desktop computer that got hacked, it didn't really matter for the most part. But now when we have all of these things around us, you know, Fitbits, there was the story about Fitbits being hacked, right? All your cell phone apps being hacked. So it's not just all these new devices are hackable, which means that what I call our threat surface area, the number of places where we could be hacked, is growing exponentially, but it's also all of our critical infrastructures, bridges, tunnels, power grid, hospitals, 911 systems, the financial markets, all of that is online too. And those are the critical infrastructures that run this country. And all of those can be taken down. And there have been lots of examples where that has happened. So we're rapidly running towards new and new technology. Everybody loves new tech today. The new iPhone is coming out, and I'm sure millions of people will rush out and buy one. But we don't think about the flip side of this technology. We're just enamored with all of this stuff. And we buy it and we adapt it. We don't think about it. You know, right now, one of the biggest crazes out there is this Pokemon Go phenomenon, where people like are going to chase around little augmented reality characters and try to collect points and do that. And it sounds great. But of course, criminals were all over that in 2 seconds. And one of my favorite story is, for your listeners who don't know, Pokemon Go is like a game that you can play on your phone. And
sure.
it's kind of like a modern treasure hunt where you can use your phone and all these little cartoon characters appear in real world scenarios projected on your phone. And the more you capture, the more points you get. And so people are running around town trying to get these. And my favorite example of this was a group of 11 kids in Indiana who a criminal was able to trick these 11 high school students to show up in his neighborhood with all their brand new Apple phones. And he tricked them to go after this particular little virtual, you know, creature. And when they all showed up to capture the creature, he was waiting there with a gun.
He was the creature.
He was a creature with you know, a 45, who pointed it at all these teenagers who were scared to death and all handed over their iPhones.
Wow.
Criminals, as soon as something comes out, criminals are ready to jump all over it.
You know, Mark, I mean, I guess the question of it is, and it, this kind of really shows our vulnerabilities, but and when you're talking about the hackability of it, have you found it is difficult? Does it require a high level of kind of technology proficiency? Are we, you know, when we talk about these criminals and things like that, are we talking about whiz kids? Or are we talking about people who can just download, you know, who can find certain things in certain places and then they can easily implement it without having a degree from MIT? I mean, where is a proficiency level where people can, you know, actually kind of make us vulnerable?
Yeah, it's changing, and it's actually mirroring what's going on with real technology. So again, 35 years ago, if I told you you'd be using a computer, you'd be like, why would I be using a computer? I'm a police officer. I would never use a computer.
Right.
But obviously, people are using these tools in the same way that the general public is adapting to tools. So are criminals in the technological world. And in the same way that our tools are becoming easier to use, right? I mean, think about all the stuff that you can do with apps today. Anybody can be a photographer with an iPhone. The same is happening in the world of cybercrime. So, you know, your vision of the, you know, teenage hacker in his mom's basement, like that movie War Games in the 1980s or 1990s, that was the old school hacker where you actually needed to be technologically sophisticated to carry out a crime. Today, what has happened is those old school, really smart, techno savvy criminals have created apps and training programs to teach baby criminals how they can get in on all of this too. Now the level of knowledge required to be a hacker has dropped phenomenally. There are YouTube videos on how to hack, on how to break into people's phones. There are things that you can buy for 20, 30 bucks out there that will go ahead and hack somebody's cell phone, allow you to track them, take over their video camera and all of that stuff. So actually it's going the opposite way. The tools of hacking are becoming democratized. And now we're seeing a lot of sort of lower level criminals that have no hacking skills are now getting into this point and click crime, which is available. There's a tool called Black Shades, which is about 2,500 bucks. And it's like,
and Mark, hold on before you go into detail, we got to take a quick break. I want you to come into Black Shades right quick. And because, you know, what you're talking about is what we need to know. But we got to take a quick break and then we're going to continue this conversation. We're talking to Mark Goodman. He is the author. And as you're hearing right now, Mark knows what he's talking about, but he's the author of Future Crimes. It's a book I think you should read. I mean, all our federal agencies need to read it. And also, just as an individual, I think this thing will really enlighten you as we kind of think about, you know, those in the military and government and other, our own operation, our own personal security, our own cybersecurity, not only for our agencies, but also for ourselves and our companies and everything else, as we really kind of think about the next phase of cybercrime, the next phase of future crimes that deals with technology. We're going to take a quick break. Listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been talking about crimes. We're talking about cybercrime. We're talking about future crimes, crimes that's using technology, crimes that's using our computers, crimes that's using the internet and a number of different things in order to really make us vulnerable, to grab intellectual property, to grab personal information that could be used against us, whether somebody's getting our social security number or our credit card numbers, or as we just have been talking about the OPM hack, where some people have, you know, personal information about us that can be, that could really make us vulnerable and to espionage and a number of other things. All this stuff is out here, and there are criminals who are starting to take advantage of this technology, and we've seen it, but it's starting to evolve, especially as our world is becoming a lot more connected. We're talking to Mark Goodman. He is the author of Future Crimes, and he is one of the premier experts who's really kind of diving into this stuff. Mark, I want you to really give the book website and then give how people can find you, whether it be Twitter or any other social media that you're using, Mark.
Sure. The book, as you mentioned, is at futurecrimes.com or futurecrimesbook.com. And people can follow me on Twitter at Future Crimes. That's where I'm tweeting about the latest, greatest, craziest hacks out there. So if you want to be on top of what's going on in this field, Future Crimes on Twitter is a great place to check out.
You know, Mark, you were talking about the black shades and talking about kind of the dynamics of that. Continue with that conversation that we left off on the break in terms of you know, how these criminals are now, you don't have to be a whiz kid. Basically, there's a whole market out there of people developing tools for criminals to use, and they can buy them.
Absolutely. Black shades is just one example, but it's a tool that will allow you to infect somebody's computer, put a virus on a USB stick, take over their camera, take over their phone, and launch ransomware. And it's all crime at the click of the mouse. You just need to just put in your target's email address or a bunch of email addresses, and you are off to the races. So, you know, for it's like any startup, right? You put in a $2,500 investment, and you're now in business. And there are even free programs out there, YouTube programs where you can just learn how to be a hacker. And there's something called the dark web, where it's sort of a walled off part of the internet that you require special software to get to. But once you're launched on the dark web, it is basically crime university, and you can find anything you want to learn right there. So that's another reason why we've seen this uptick. We've seen the uptick in cybercrime massively. There was a study that came out by Juniper Research that said by 2020, cybercrime is going to cost the world $3 trillion a year.
Wow.
So the numbers are jumping up crazy in the wrong direction. And that's something that we need to begin to focus on and deal with.
So, Mark, when it comes to this situation with the corporations and other things like that, people are, and we deal with Apple and Androids, and we're always seeing software that's being vulnerable. But you've got a unique solution on how to deal with, like, hackers and when people discover these security vulnerabilities. I mean, what is that? I know you talk about it in the book. What is that solution?
Well, basically, it's crowdsourcing our response, and I'll explain what I mean by that. For the longest time, the police were the police and the people were the people, and I think it's time for the people and the police to come together, because in this particular crime, cybercrime, the police cannot do it by their own. If you look at the typical homicide scene, the cops always put up the yellow tape, and it says, police line, do not cross, and that might have worked back in the day, but now we need a new approach. We need a new paradigm. We need the public to cross, because frankly, the police don't have the expertise or the budget to be able to afford all of the experts that they need. So if you can go ahead and start off your career, you know, making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 as a police officer, that's great. But if you've got some technical skill, you can go also walk over to Google and make $200,000 a year. So how are we going to attract the people with the right technical talent into the police? And I don't think we're ever going to be paying street cops, you know, $200,000-$300,000 a year.
Right.
So what we need to do,
maybe in Dubai, ahead. Maybe in Dubai,
maybe,
Mark.
Yeah, maybe they'll be driving around in gold,
right? Exactly.
BMWs or something. But you know what we need to do is make a real strong partnership between the public and private sector, because there are so many people in the private sector that have lots of expertise that can help their government, that can help their community. You look at all these Iraq and Afghanistan vets that are coming back that have tremendous skills, that could volunteer in their communities to help police, that could bring together the expertise. All these engineers working at Facebook, Google, Dell, Boeing, I mean, all of these inside the Beltway companies that have tremendous experience that they could bring to bear on this problem. So that's one opportunity. The other opportunity is that we need to go ahead and crowdsource the general public to get involved with this so that they know where to report these crimes. Right now, we have a very clear system. If you see a drive-by shooting, if you see somebody graffitiing something, if you see somebody stealing a car, we all know to dial 911.
Right.
But what's 911 on the internet? It doesn't exist. So we need to be able to develop ways where the public can communicate what they're seeing out there directly with law enforcement. And law enforcement will say, well, we have this special thing on a web page that's hidden, and if you click on these 42 buttons, you might find it. But the public's not going to do all that work. We need to do a much better job communicating that and to crowdsource our security to get people involved in this, because we need the skill set very, very desperately. And the bad guys are crowdsourcing their attacks. We need to crowdsource our responses as well.
You know, Mark, and before we break to the next segment and talk about solutions, you had a interesting thing about, like, you know, in screens we trust and most screens, more problems. Kind of talk to me a little bit about what you were kind of talking about in the book in screens we trust.
Sure. Well, every day we see information on our computer screens. If we're driving down the street and our GPS says, you know, turn right on K Street, people are going to turn right on K Street. And if you see on your phone that you got a text message from your boyfriend or girlfriend, then you're going to believe that that text message comes from your boyfriend or girlfriend. We look at information on screens, but we forget that screens aren't reality, right? If I walk up to Derek and punch you in the face, you'll know, hey, that was Mark that punched you right in the face. And I'm sure you'll punch right back. But the fact of the matter is, on a phone, we actually don't know. I can make your phone show you a text message that looked like it came from your mom or your girlfriend or your boyfriend, and they never sent the message. Or I could go ahead and trick your GPS to change its location, and you would never know. So my point is that people forget. We've just sort of subjugated our minds to screens where we believe in everything that the screens tell us, but screens can lie because screens are nothing but computers, and those computers can be manipulated. So one of the things, you know, I talk about in that chapter, Most Screens, More Problems, is trying to get people on board with the idea that that information can be manipulated and to have a healthy set of skepticism. You know, right now we have all these scams going around where people are getting emails allegedly from the IRS saying, oh, you owe us money or you have to pay this fine. There's a great scam going on right now where people are hacking the GPS location of your phone and they're using that as a fake scam for speed trap tickets. Wow. So we'll say, hey, we know that Derek was at, you know, 12th and K Street last week at 2 p.m., and you will get an automatic email because your phone's been hacked. So we know that your phone was at 12th at K last Tuesday at 2 p.m., and you're going to get an email that looks like it comes from the police, and it will say, hey, we have a red light camera violation of you at this location, and you need to pay this fine.
Wow.
And it's not the police, and people are opening up their credit cards and paying criminals who are just tricking them. So you really need to have a healthy skepticism about anything that you see on the screen and get real in the real world. If you have a question, if you have a doubt, call the real police and ask them, right? Call the real IRS. The IRS does not email you and tell you to send them money on PayPal, right?
Exactly.
You need to use
exactly
a little bit of common sense.
We're talking to Mark Goodman. He is the author of Future Crimes. You can find his book at futurecrimes.com or futurecrimesbook.com. We got a few minutes left with him on the next segment. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch from Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been talking to Mark Goodman. He is the author of Future Crimes. We have been talking about cyber crimes and future crimes. We've been talking about the vulnerabilities that really all of our society has, whether it be our companies, our federal agencies, our international agencies, or our us as individuals. There are a number of different vulnerabilities. It's great to have the technology, but it also presents some new challenges out there. We have also been discussing now, and we want to discuss what are some of the solutions. We mentioned some of these things in the beginning, but now we want to talk about some of the solutions on how people, how individuals and maybe organizations can deal with some of these things. Mark, what would be some of the advice? I know you give some tips in the book and I know you give some tips on your website. What would be some of the advice on terms of solutions on how we deal with some of this stuff?
Yeah, one of the smartest things you can do is never, ever go on the internet and to throw your phone into the river. No, I'm just
throw all technology, throw all technology into the river.
Exactly.
Typewriters.
go get a tinfoil hat and go live in a cave. No, I'm not suggesting that at all. Look, technology is great. Technology is going to do a lot of good things for us and for society. We just need to make sure that the tools are working for us and we're not working for the tools. So there's a six-step process that I wrote about in the book called the Update Protocol. And before I get into it, I'll tell all your listeners that this is all available for free on my website. If you go to futurecrimes.com and click on tips, T-I-P-S, there's a whole infographic that explains the six things that you can do. And there are things like passwords, and I'll just use that as an example, right? We all have heard that our passwords need to be long and strong, and we need to change them all the time. And yet we get that that's a pain in the butt. And the overwhelming majority of people in America still have password 123 as their password, right? 70% of people use the same password across multiple sites, and 50% of people haven't changed their passwords in the past 5 years. So why is that important? Because the passwords are the key to your kingdom. If you don't lock down those passwords, people are going to use it to get into your bank account, into your social media account, into your kids' account, and the like. So you need to stay on top of that. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say you should develop a 50-digit password, because none of us can remember that. But here's the good news, as just one example of the six things that you can do. There are tools out there called password managers, companies like Dashlane, 1Password, LastPass, companies like that. And these are basically password vaults or wallets where you can manage 500 passwords, and it will keep them all safe and secure for you. They'll all be long. You don't have to memorize anything, and they're great tools for people to use. So,
Mark, let me ask this really, really quick. You know, because you mentioned about software coming online and apps and things like that. How do you determine if an app is legitimate? I mean, what are your steps that you take in order to make sure you are using a legitimate app from a legitimate company and not a fake app that somebody has now developed to get your information?
Well, it's funny you mention that, because there definitely are fake apps out there to get your information. I would say you have to use common sense. And one of the things that people might look at is, well, how many downloads does this app has? Oh, it has 10 million downloads. It must be legit. But criminals are really good at tricking people into downloading stuff. And I always give the example of something called like Best Flashlight 2015. It was an app that had over like 10 million downloads. And it was just an app. All it did was turn on the flashlight on your phone. But here's the funny thing. When you went to launch the app, and particularly in Android, it would say things like, oh, Best Flashlight app needs access to your contacts. All right, use a little common sense.
Why is that flashlight app
need access to your contacts? Right. And then it said, Best Flashlight app needs access to your location. And I always say, I'm located in the dark.
Right.
That's why I need a flashlight.
Right.
That's all
right.
You need to know. You don't need to know what part of town I'm in. So use common sense. And only download apps from the official app stores. This is particularly true with Android. There are dozens of, you know, these so-called other app stores out there. Watch them very closely. There's been a ton of malware that has gotten into the Android world. I'm not shilling for Apple here, but I will tell you, based upon research, Android phones are targeted 99% of the time because they're just easier to break into for a whole variety of reasons. So 99% of the computer malware that's out there is targeting Android phones as opposed to the iPhone. So that's just the fact. I'm not saying anything bad about
sure.
Android. I'm just saying that the bad guys are able to break into them more successfully. So look at it, use common sense, and see who's developed the app, right? See what you can find out about the people. If you can say, oh, Joe Smith developed it, and he's got an office in Chicago or Seattle, and you know, they're a legit-looking company, then download it. But remember, if your app is free, free is often the most expensive price in the world. They get you one way or the other.
That's right. Hey, Mark, I know you got to go in a minute or so. You got a couple things, like download and admin. Can you just talk about that real quick? Because I think people need to understand about downloading, and then also just the administrative dynamics of keeping your computer secure.
Yeah, so these are a little bit more complex. I'll give you the easier ones first. Number one, update your software. Every time you update your software, you're blocking doors and windows for hackers to break in because they've caught system errors, bugs, and all those updates fix the bugs. So set all your software to automatically update on your phone and on your computer. Watch what you download. If you're going out there for sites that will have free, you know, quote unquote movies and free books and free music, again, the reason why these movies are free is because those movies files are riddled with malware and virus that will get into your system. The concept of an administrator computer is a little complex. It is explained on that infographic that I mentioned at futurecrimes.com, tips. Just click on tips. But the idea is that if you're using your computer as an administrator, then anything goes. If you're the administrator of your computer, it means you've got the highest level privileges. You can change any setting you want. And criminals count on that because when they infect you with a virus, they're making changes that the system should not change. And if you're logged in as administrator, you won't even notice that those changes are being made. So instead, don't surf the internet on an administrator account. This is true for both Windows and Mac. Go in and instead create a separate user account. Use the user account to do all your online surfing and your daily work. And then if you need to administer your computer, for example, you need to install a new piece of software, then log in as administrator. But being logged in as administrator 100% of the time is really dangerous for you. So all of those tips are out there and available for free.
Hey, Mark, I'm going to tell you, that is one of the tips that I immediately did after I read your book. I went through, changed my administrative, different passwords, but then, you know, changed myself from being the administrator, and it completely made sense. So I want you to know that that is impact. Give the information real quick where they can find you and on Twitter and the website and everything else.
Sure. So let me just say, by the way, regarding that update protocol, the steps to keep you safe, if you do that, you will reduce your risk of cyber attack by 85%. That's a really important thing I forgot to mention.
Wow.
So this isn't theoretical. This is based upon research from the Australian Ministry of Defense. Do these things and you will reduce your risk of being attacked online by 85% via cyber attack.
And Mark, how important is encryption? I know you mentioned this real, because we talked about the update. Is encryption critical too?
It is, particularly the concept of using a VPN, a virtual private network. If you're out there surfing the internet at Starbucks or your local university or in some hotel or airport, then everybody can see what you're doing on your machine. I go to airports all the time, and it's super easy to see everything from people's iTunes playlists to the emails that they're sending to what they're posting on Facebook. So you just need to beware and use encryption via VPN. How to get in touch with me, like I said, you can check out futurecrimes.com. Lots of information there, or you can follow me at Future Crimes.
We're going to definitely try to have Mark back. I mean, there's so much in the book that I wanted to cover, but we don't have enough time. But Mark, one, just thank you for providing the insight. Thank you for the book and providing all the insight that you have given. And I definitely want you to come back at some point in time.
All right, Derek. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.